You're listening to Labor Express, Chicago's only labor news and current affairs radio program. News for working people by working people. I'm your host, Jeremy Lacero, and this is the Sunday, November 18th, 2007 edition of Labor Express. Well, I'm back from my visit to Cincinnati, Ohio, and NALOC's annual leadership assembly. I hope you all enjoyed our special edition of Building Bridges Radio that we offered on our last week's program instead of Labor Express. I want to thank Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg for allowing us to air episodes of Building Bridges here in Chicago on a somewhat occasional basis, and sometimes we do air segments of their programs in our program as well, and I really appreciate them letting us do that. Building Bridges is a terrific program on WBAI out in New York. You can find out more about their program by going to their website, which is www.buildingbridgesonline.org. So buildingbridgesonline.org. By the way, they're actually currently looking for volunteers to help maintain their website. So if you have any website design skills and are interested in helping out a pioneering labor program like Building Bridges, look them up. Of course, keep us in mind, too. We could definitely use some assistance with our website as well. So if you have those skills and you really want to help out, check out laborexpress.org as well as how to get a hold of us and help us out as well. Well, tonight's program, we have an interview with NALOC's Executive Director, Oscar Chacon, which I recorded at the Leadership Assembly last weekend. NALOC is the National Alliance of Latin American and Caribbean Communities. We'll hear more about that tonight. He'll talk about the state of the organization and its goals for the coming year. Then we'll hear an interview with students from the University of Chicago, members of SOL. That's the Students Organizing United with Labor. They'll talk about the their recently concluded week of action to support the efforts of Teamster Local 743 employees of the university in their effort to reach a fair contract settlement. But first, we have this week's Labor News Highs from WIN, Workers Independent News.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
And I'm Jesse Russell. The entertainment industry has entered Act Two in the drama of fed-up workers. On Saturday, Broadway lights dimmed as the stagehands walked off the job at 26 theaters seeking job protection. The League of American Theaters and Producers has been seeking more flexibility when it comes to how many stagehands should be hired per show. Flyers handed out by members of the Stagehands Union explain that while Broadway producers are reaping large profits, they are seeking to limit jobs available to employees. According to the union, less stagehands means greater safety risks, amongst other issues. On the flip side, the producers are arguing that while some productions are seeing a boom in revenue, only one in five are actually profitable, and current production hiring rules required by the union's contract are outdated. Meanwhile, scriptwriters and supporters in Hollywood continue to walk the picket lines. While showrunners had hoped that backlog scripts would keep Hollywood up and running minus writers for at least until the end of the year, unexpected solidarity from actors has led to an early end to some big-name shows, including NBC's The Office. Many of Fox's animated shows may also soon be creeping to a halt, as producers are often writers. For example, all of the writers for The Simpsons are on the picket lines, so last-minute script changes and animation approvals cannot be completed. Additionally, reinforcements may be on the way. According to trade magazine Broadcasting and Cable, the 500 employees at CBS News who have been without a contract since April of 2005 will be voting on their own strike authorization this coming Thursday. The publication also reports rumblings of job action by the 2,500 ABC Disney camera operators and video editors who have also been without a contract since March, and the 200 ABC News writers who have been without a contract since 2005. From blogs to YouTube, striking television writers are showing the power of new media in a big way. It shouldn't be a surprise, as new media is at the core of the negotiation breakdown with Hollywood producers. The writers want compensation for when their material appears on the internet or other new technologies. The Writers Guild of America has been posting daily videos that detail the issues, captured life on the strike lines, and even feature cameos from the actors who are dependent on scripts for their shows and movies. One video captures members of the Screen Actors Guild joining a picket at Universal Studios. Zach Braff is an actor on Scrubs and also a WGA member.
I think the studios need to learn to share all that secret internet money that they know they're making.
Sarah Silverman is an actor and writer for The Sarah Silverman Show.
All the writers want is a small percentage of the money that the producers are making on the things that they're writing. They're getting zero.
Nia Vardalos is a writer and actor.
Here today, striking for the generation of writers behind me in the same way that writers before me struck for me and got me health care.
Take, take, take. That's the corporate mantra in America, from the auto shop floor at GM, Ford, and Chrysler to the Broadway stage, and they're taking it from workers. Members of the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees are the latest to rise up to defend families and their homes in the Broadway strike. Broadway producers want a 38% cut in jobs and wages taken from workers, even as the $1 billion-a-year industry profits. The Broadway stage workers pulled their picket line on Monday so that a benefit show for mentally challenged children could be staged at the Marriott Marquis Theater in New York City. But they want respect from Broadway producers, and they want to be treated honorably at the bargaining table. The producers want to use as few workers as possible to stage their shows, while the union wants to make sure that the shows are professionally staged and staged safely with an adequate full staff. The UAW reached a tentative agreement with Ford Motor Company on a new contract early Saturday morning after very short strikes at GM and Chrysler. The Ford agreement was reached without a strike after talks intensified late last week. Details on the proposed deal have not been officially released, but they're expected to mirror the GM and Chrysler deals, which included the companies turning over retiree health care to the union in exchange for tens of billions of dollars in savings for the companies. The Ford deal also reportedly includes a two-tier pay system, allowing the company to hire thousands of new workers at about half the wages of current UAW members at Ford. Ford wants to cut its workforce by another 13,000 with buyout and early retirement incentives, and has plans to shut 16 factories in a massive downsizing. UAW President Ron Gettelfinger says the union came through for its active and retired members in a final 41-hour bargaining session with Ford. The UAW says its goals in the Ford talks were to win new product and investments from Ford for UAW-represented U.S. plants, get job security, and protect seniority rights. UAW Ford workers have ratified the tentative contract with Ford. The UAW says it protects wages, benefits, and seniority for active members, and says it also provides income and health care security for retired Ford UAW members. But as the publication In These Times notes, the U.S. auto contracts negotiated by the UAW this year effectively repeal the landmark 1950 Treaty of Detroit contracts. Those contracts not only lifted up auto workers' families with good wages and benefits, but set a high bar that became the de facto manufacturing wage and benefits standard in America. Thanks to these 2007 contract agreements, thousands of the next generation of UAW auto workers will earn half what current workers earn, will have no company-guaranteed health care in retirement, and have less retirement security. Hundreds of workers led by the AFL-CIO rallied in Washington, D.C. at the National Labor Relations Board on Thursday. They were protesting the board's recent anti-worker decisions. Fred Ascarati, director of Voice at Work, was one of the protesters.
A bunch of decisions that make it harder for workers to organize, to majority sign up, decisions that take away the workers' rights, were illegally fired to back pay, that make our bad labor laws even worse.
This is the agency that is supposed to be protecting employee rights. And instead of protecting employee rights, they are violating the law themselves.
Eric Brooks, president of the National Labor Relations Board Union. The Bush National Labor Relations Board is guilty of violating federal labor law for refusing to bargain with the union. That's according to a Federal Labor Relations Authority judge. The NLRB is illegally refusing to bargain with a consolidated union bargaining unit representing 1,000 NLRB workers. The NLRB is supposed to uphold the rights of workers to collectively bargain, but instead it's violating its own workers' labor rights. Brooks says if NLRB General Counsel Ronald Meisberg can't obey labor law as he's sworn to do, then he should hit the road.
If the agency won't honor the law in the public sector, can the employees in the private sector that are under the NLRB's jurisdiction count on the NLRB to enforce the law and protect their own rights? We think it's time that the General Counsel either start to obey the law, or if he can't do that, then he should resign.
Workers at the National Labor Relations Board are barred from striking, but they're using informational pickets and all legal means available to force the Boise NLRB to obey labor law and respect the labor rights of its own employees. SEIU Houston janitors will soon celebrate a triumphant anniversary.
Next week will mark the historic victory in which SEIU janitors in Houston won their first contract. On the heels of this anniversary, janitors, along with their families and community supporters, announced the launch of yet another campaign in the Lone Star State. Their target this time, as activist Maria Jimenez shares, is Aramark.
Today, we are inspired to see Aramark workers taking on your own fight for a better future. Just as we stood with Houston janitors, we are ready to stand beside Aramark workers.
Aramark currently has contracts with many Houston area arenas, stadiums, theaters, and universities. Aramark is the second largest corporation of its kind in the country and posted over $11 billion in profits last year. The average salary of a Houston area Aramark employee is just above $7 an hour, with no health care or paid vacation. Reporting from Houston, Texas, I'm Rachel Clark with Workers Independent News.
Helene Bonneau of the French Labor Federation, CGT, says the French transport strike is a defense not only of pensions, but the overall social contract French workers have won through decades of struggle. Bonneau says the right-wing Sarkozy government is not unlike Ronald Reagan in its attack on workers and their unions.
Government wanted a clash in order to get rid of the trade union movement. So we have to avoid a clash which would be destructive for the trade union movement. And at the same time, we want to achieve something in terms of pension for all the workers concerned.
The Socialist Party in France supports the strike. Bonneau says negotiations are underway on the reforms Sarkozy is demanding, but she says Sarkozy is trying to dictate the framework while threatening to impose changes that would force public workers to work more years before qualifying for their full pensions. The United Steelworkers are encouraging Grupo Mexico to pay attention to a new report for the sake of Mexican mine workers. Jesse Russell reports.
According to the United Steelworkers, a new report highlighting serious health and safety violations at copper mines owned by Grupo Mexico in Sonora, Mexico, is a wake-up call. The report discovered failing equipment, high levels of toxic dust and acid mist, and a lack of health and safety programs to educate workers. The USW represents Grupo Mexico workers at mines in Texas and Arizona. They issued the statement in solidarity with the Mexican workers.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And you're listening to Labor Express Radio News for working people by working people, and that was this week's Labor News highlights from WIN, Workers Independent News. I want to thank WIN for allowing us to broadcast their material, and I want to encourage our listeners to check out the WIN website, which is www.laborradio.org. You can also find a link to the WIN website on our website, which is www.laborexpress.org. Well, a couple of weeks ago, I was pleased to have Richard Berg, the new president-elect of Teamsters Local 743, live in the studio. We talked while he was here about the many years of struggle it took Richard and the other reformers in his local to take control of their union. And now the local enters its first major battle under the new leadership at the University of Chicago, where 1,100 clerical and maintenance employees are fighting for a cost-of-living increase in their pay. The new reform leadership at Teamsters 743 has a major ally in this fight, U of C students organized into a student group called SOUL, Students Organizing United with Labor. Today wrapped up a week of action and education organized by SOUL, in which the students call attention to the demands of 743 members and put pressure on the university to bargain in good faith with its employees. I met up with a few members of SOUL on Friday evening down at U of C's campus. They explained to me the purpose of SOUL and how they are mobilizing to support Local 743 in their contract fight.
I'm Nathan Wilmes, and I'm an activist with Students Organizing United with Labor, SOUL, at the University of Chicago.
I am Sarah Jankowski, and I also work with SOUL, the labor group here at the University of Chicago.
I thought we could start off by talking a little bit about SOUL. We haven't talked about SOUL on the program previously, so I think it's important people know about your organization and what you guys are doing down here at U of C.
Absolutely. Well, we are involved heavily with the labor movement on campus. We've run a number of different campaigns. Last year, we ran a Kick Coke Off Campus campaign pretty vigorously. And this year, we're working with the local 743 Teamsters Union, whose contract has been up for negotiation on campus. And we've been supporting them throughout their negotiations to get 4% annual raises on campus.
Yeah, and SOUL is a United Students Against Sweatshops chapter. So, like Sarah mentioned, some of the campaigns we've been involved with have been sort of USAS international solidarity campaigns, but we've also been doing solidarity stuff with campus workers.
Yeah, I think if anybody's familiar with U of C's role over the last few years in the movement, it's been primarily on the sweatshop issues, on the whole effort to get Taco Bell off campus with the Coalition of Mochi Workers campaign. You mentioned the Coca-Cola campaign. So there's been this focus on student labor support in kind of the broadest sense in terms of, you know, farm workers in Florida and Colombian trade unionists in Colombia and the Coke campaign. But in this case of SOUL and the current efforts that you're doing with Teamsters 743, this is kind of a local labor struggle that you're becoming involved in this case.
Yeah, I mean, that is true. But even throughout its history, sort of SOUL has been involved with sort of campus worker stuff. several years ago, Richard Berg, who's now the president-elect of Local 743, was actually fired from the University of Chicago Hospital for doing labor organizing. And so we held a rally with workers and Richard at that point. And we've sort of been in touch with campus workers for a couple years now. And then just last year, several workers came to us and contacted us about working with them on the current contract struggle.
So what are the major issues in this current contract struggle with the university? Are there specific things that the workers are looking for? Have there been real concerns they've had in the previous contract?
Absolutely. Well, contract negotiations, let me start off. The workers have been going at this since January is when their contract expired. And so they've been without a contract for about 8 months now. And what they're asking for is 4% annual raises to keep up with inflation. And what the university has offered in their contract is 3% annual raises. And since then, they've been in and out of negotiations, and the university has really been very unwilling to budge, even though it's a rather small amount of money that the university would actually be giving up. In total, it's about $400,000 split between about 1,200 workers, which is less than individual administrators make here. So you can really say that it's kind of pennies that the university is fighting over at this point. And when it's come to them making additional offers, they still have not come even close to the 4% that the workers have been asking for.
Yeah, and just a little more history on it. I guess the last like two or three contracts, the university has been pretty adamant about only giving 3% annual wage increases. And basically, 3% just does not keep up with the rising cost of living here in Chicago. And so this year, when workers heard that the contract was coming up and negotiations would be started, they sort of decided to put their foot down this time and really run a vigorous campaign against the university, trying to get the wage that they deserve.
One of the reasons why that's actually really important, I just want to jump in, is because the workers have not voted down a contract that the university has given them in several years. I'm not exactly sure about the correct number, but this is never, says Nate. So this is huge. And when they voted down the contract originally, it was something like 433 to 27 or some enormous amount. So workers really came together over this and are looking for significant increases that will keep up with the cost of living.
You mentioned Richard Berg and the recent victory in Teamster 743, where Richard and his reform slate have swept the positions in the union. Do you think that played a role too in why maybe the workers are more resistant this time and are willing to take a stronger stand against the university?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely a feeling here on campus and even off campus, Local 743 members I've spoken to, that it's time. They've had enough of corrupt union leadership, and they've had enough of the union basically being in cahoots with the bosses and with university administration. And really rank and file workers have decided that they've had enough of that, and it's time for a new model of the way unions are run.
Now, I'm going to ask a question that I'm sure you hear all the time from outsiders, and maybe it bugs the heck out of you, but you know, I think a lot of people looking from the outside would say, okay, University of Chicago students, these are students that probably come from a background where they have some money and so on. What makes them interested in being a part of a labor struggle like this? What, you know, how do they see their concerns and interests and so on connected with these workers on campus?
Well, I think it's important to be involved as students with the issues that are going on in our campus, you know? I mean, if the workers that are essentially there providing services for us and making this university run for us, the students, you know, and we don't have any say or we aren't standing up for them, I actually think that it's difficult not to get involved as opposed to what makes us interested. How can you not be interested in the rights of the people who are really making it possible for us to be here?
Yeah, and I think that's definitely an important question to keep in mind, like, in student labor activism in general, because obviously there's sort of like, I guess what I would call the 1990s anti-sweatshop model of like students helping the poor workers who are having trouble in, you know, third world countries. And I think that speaking for myself and I think many people in Seoul, like that's really not what's going on here. The workers contacted us and said, these are things you can do to support our struggle. And, you know, we were happy to be involved in that.
How does the university react to that? Like, have you got a sense that they're at all surprised or how do they react to the fact that students, their own students on their campus are standing in solidarity with these workers who clearly they have refused to negotiate with, or refused to negotiate in good faith with?
It makes them nervous, to say the very least. You know, one thing that's good about us being able to help out the Teamsters Local 743 is that we are students and we have time on our hands, and a lot of things that the workers can't necessarily do because they are working full-time jobs and have families and things like that, we're able to assist them in those efforts. So together with the union, we've put on rallies and been able to gather students in great numbers to really support this issue. So bringing the press out and things like that, that's an important issue, and the university doesn't like to look bad. So
yeah, and when other thing, I guess, I would add to that question is that, getting the press out tonight, we have two students speaking, but in general, workers have been the contact people for the press, which I think is definitely a better model than students speaking for workers. Unfortunately, tonight, Friday night, people weren't able to make it out.
About activities that you've done and support of the workers, you mentioned rallies. You had one tonight that unfortunately I wasn't able to make it down here for in time. But what are some of the ways that you, what are some of the concrete actions you've taken in support of the workers?
Well, actually, this is our week of action right now. And one of the main points of this was just to get the word out and make sure that the university knows that we want this to be really visible. And so if you walk throughout our campus, you'll see big 4% signs on all of the trees. So everybody walking by knows that, you know, that there's an issue going on here. And on all the fours, it says support campus workers. So all the students start wondering, and, you know, any visiting professors start wondering. And so it's really creating a buzz around campus. And not only Seoul has been involved in this movement, but all sorts of different activist groups on campus have really been supporting this. We've had Students for Human Rights delivering some contracts from other schools, peer institutions, that do give their workers 4% and 5% raises per year. You know, we think that that's important. So we have all sorts of groups organizing around this issue. Nate, if you'd like to add some other things.
Yeah, and I mean, just taking it back a little bit, the first sort of steps that Seoul took when workers started talking to us last, like, December, January-ish, the main thing they were asking for was just having us go out and talk to workers about what's going on. I mean, the vast majority of people in this bargaining unit are clerical workers, and that sort of work, is really not a socialized sort of workplace where everybody's together and able to talk about the issues they face as workers and union members. And so many people we talked to didn't know that they were represented by the union, or didn't know that contract negotiations were starting up, and certainly didn't know that workers were starting to organize around it. So one thing that students could do that workers really couldn't, because they were working during the time when the union members were at their workplaces, was just go around and start talking to people. And ultimately, that those sort of small discussions culminated in Seoul finding space for campus worker lunch meetings. At these meetings, you know, Seoul would find the space and try to get some food out for people. But the workers would totally run the meetings, and basically from there started really organizing themselves on a mass scale. So,
yeah, one thing I just realized that we didn't really talk about is who these workers are that are represented by 743 on campus. Can you give me a little description of who these workers are?
Yeah, so there's about 1,100 ish people. We sort of get different numbers from the university and the union and other sources, but between 1050 and 1100 workers, most of them are clerical workers, the people who work at the front desks in dormitories, the people who answer the phones in academic departments, a number of positions that are classified as clerical work. And then in addition, there's some service and maintenance workers who are also covered by the same contract. Almost all of them do housekeeping work in dormitories. So all of these positions are positions where students come in contact with these workers frequently. So I think definitely that's helped sort of build student involvement with these workers.
One thing I wonder, too, is how widespread is the student support for this effort? Obviously, you know, organizations like Seoul usually are, of course, a minority of the total student body, but sometimes you know, depending on the struggle, you can get, you know, majority of the student body behind the effort, or other times, unfortunately, that doesn't happen. What's been the case so far with Seoul? Do you get a sense that a good number or a good percentage of the student body here at the university is supporting your work?
I think we can definitely say that a majority of the student body is really behind us on this issue. I mean, we've gone out and done petitioning just to get the word out. And, you know, when you're talking to somebody and you say, hey, you know, do you want your campus workers to have a fair contract? You know, people don't just walk on by for that. People will stop and people will get interested and say, okay, well, tell me a little bit more about this. You know, what's a fair contract? You know, and once they really hear the issues and the amount of money that the workers are asking for, people get behind the movement, and that's been demonstrated in the events that we've put on. The student body has come out in large numbers.
Yeah, and I think that other indicators of sort of student support are not only the petition that we had, but also about 20 student organizations signed on to a petition that was specifically for groups and saying that we support campus worker demands for a 4% wage increase. Among these are MECHA, the Mexican American Student Group, Organization of Black Students, Students for Human Rights, the Anti-Genocide Coalition. A number of groups have really gotten behind this. In addition, recently, the president of student government sort of wanted to talk to us about possibly endorsing this, which we're a little unsure about, because one thing that we've been really careful of in this campaign is that we never want to be in a position where students are negotiating with administrators on behalf of workers, because obviously that's like one step away from union busting. So we've really worked to sort of bring this mass student support in a way that pressures administrators and supports workers, but that isn't, you know, directly dealing with the administrators.
You mentioned that because of the jobs that most of these workers have, they do have regular contact with students and so on in the university community. I'm curious, since you've seen this campaign launch and so on, have you seen like kind of conversations develop between students and workers about this issue? I mean, you know, I think, you know, generally speaking, on a college campus, frequently, even though the students and the workers may encounter each other on a daily basis, they probably don't generally have long conversations with each other. And in most cases, have you seen like a real dialogue develop between the workers and the students, partly because of this work, do you think?
Definitely. Students who work with the organization, we put up YouTube clips and the workers have been watching them, and so they'll see students in there. And as students are walking in and out of their dorms, the clerical workers will say, hey, I saw you on that video. I just wanted to say thanks so much for being out there in support of us. We really appreciate that. We've had editorials written, and the workers will email the students who've written the editorials and say, listen, that was amazing. Thank you very much. You know, this is an important issue. And just our group in general, too. You know, we have a group email address. And so there's been all sorts of communication that's really developed around this.
Yeah. And one great anecdote, I just saw an email today that was it was sort of CC'd to me, an exchange between a Seoul member and another student who hasn't been active in the campaign, possibly an econ major, but that might be just my own prejudices coming out. And he was basically emailing saying, you know, hey, like, I've seen all these 4% signs everywhere, you know, but it really annoys me because I know that the inflation in Chicago is actually rising less than that. And he had just learned about this in his economics classes, I'm sure. And then actually the Seoul member replied to him and said, look, you know, the way that I was educated about these issues was by talking to campus workers and asking them what it is that they needed to get by in Chicago. And so he gave the name of a campus clerical worker who worked in this other kid's dorm and told him to go talk to her.
You know, one thing, too, I think that's interesting about that kind of dialogue developing between the students and the workers is that that has potentials, you know, beyond the specific campaign, too, of you know, moving into other work. I mean, I'm thinking of a former U of C student I know, Mateo, who's gone on to work in the community and help organize on housing issues and those kind of things as well with, I think, partly because of the context that he had developed in his work at the university with other working people and so on. So it seems interesting. I think this kind of work has a real potential in the broadest sense, even beyond just this a specific campaign like this.
No, it definitely does. I think that this helps to shape the views of a lot of students who are working on this campaign to have that interaction with workers and really see some of the issues that come out. And, you know, I mean, it's one thing to look at pieces of paper and say, well, this is the exact rate of inflation. It's another thing to talk to a worker who is affected by that rate of inflation, you know. So I think it has impact on the lives of the students who have been organizing around this and gives us another perspective to look at.
Now you mentioned you're wrapping up this student week of action that you did with this campaign. Where are things at with the contract negotiations at this point? I mean, are there any hopeful signs that have arisen, you know, in relation maybe to the work that you guys are doing?
So I'm not sure I would say hopeful signs exactly, but so far, just negotiations, workers have rejected two of the university's offers. Both of these contracts included far less than 4%, but incidentally more than the customary 3%. So efforts at organizing are working. The university is feeling the pressure, but I think right now they're sort of at a point where they're digging their heels in a little bit. And they've been meeting with union negotiating teams less frequently. But I think that definitely it could be resolved soon, and hopefully it will be, so that people can get a good contract and get retro pay that people definitely need from this past year of the campaign.
Well, I appreciate you guys taking on time to talk to me about this. We'll definitely follow up with you and see where these things go with the contract and also with other work that you guys are doing too. So thanks so much for talking to me.
Thanks you.
Thanks a lot, Jerry. Great.
You're listening to Labor Express, news for working people by working people. I think we have time for a real short music break tonight, and then when we come back, we'll hear about NALAC, the National Alliance of Latin American and Caribbean Communities.
Murió el chiripe mayor, quedando Román herido. Otro día por la mañana, cuando la gente llegó, unos a los otros dicen, no saben quién lo mató. Se anduvieron informando como tres horas después supieron que el malhechor era Gregorio Cortés. Exhortaron a Cortés por toditito el estado, vivo o muerto que se aprenda porque a varios ha matado. Decía Gregorio Cortés con su pistola en la mano, no siento haberlo matado, al que siento es a mi hermano. Decía Gregorio Cortés con su alma muy encendida, no siento haberlo matado, la defensa es permitida. A los americanos, si lo vemos, ¿qué le haremos? Si le entramos por derecho, muy poquitos volveremos.
You're listening to Labor Express Radio, and that was the Ballad of Gregorio Cortez, cut short a little bit there, the song about the tenant farmer in Mexico in the early part of the 20th century who was framed for being a horse thief and hunted down by the Anglo members of the community in an era in which Mexicanos were being displaced from the land after the Mexican-American War, of course. I think an excellent segue into our next part of our program. If you listen to last week's program, you'll know that I spent the weekend in Cincinnati, Ohio, attending the annual leadership assembly of NALAC, the National Alliance of Latin American and Caribbean Communities. I've had NALAC members on Labor Express a number of times in the past. I've followed developments closely in this not quite four-year-old organization, not only because my wife Claudia is the Midwest organizer for the organization, but also because I think that NALAC represents something new, unique, and exciting for immigrant organizing in the United States. It's an organization built from the grassroots through a membership of about 75 local federations, clubs, and hometown associations from Boston, Chicago, Houston, Los Angeles, Miami, New York, San Francisco, Oakland, and a whole bunch of small towns and cities across the Midwest. It's made up of immigrants from Mexico, Guatemala, Belize, El Salvador, Honduras, Colombia, and the Dominican Republic, as well as some other places in the Caribbean. And NALAC seeks to be a national organization uniting Latino immigrants. It's led by Latino immigrants, which is an important part of its mission, and has deep roots in the community, more probably than any other national organization of Latinos in the United States. NALAC has also taken a special interest in promoting a transnational agenda, bringing the perspective of immigrants to bear on issues like globalization, free trade agreements, and international economic development. They were the co-conveners of the first ever summit of the Latin American migrant communities in Morelia, Mexico last spring, representing the United States at that meeting. They played an important role in the organizing of the massive immigrant rights marches that took place around the country in 2006, and they were very important in the struggle against CAFTA. The leadership assembly this year began with a wonderful cultural and I'd say introspective event at the Cincinnati Freedom Center. The Freedom Center commemorates Cincinnati's role in the Underground Railroad, and it was a wonderful place to begin addressing one of the issues that was key to their annual meeting this year, which is how to bridge the divide between the Black and Latino communities. Over 100 representatives from around the country attended the assembly. Among the topics discussed were racism within and without the immigrant community, the role of electoral politics in the movement, the furthering of a transnational agenda, the effects of NAFTA and CAFTA on immigrant communities and on their countries back home, the state of the struggle for immigration reform, and other things. I talked with NALAC Executive Director Oscar Chacon at the conclusion of the assembly last Sunday and asked him to explain to me the purpose and mission of NALAC.
Well, the National Alliance of Latin American and Caribbean Communities is so far the largest, most representative umbrella organization which brings together Mexicans, Hondurans, Guatemalans, Salvadorians, Colombians, Dominicans, and several other nationalities of immigrants from Latin America and the Caribbean who have organized in the U.S. and who have organized not only to try to better, you know, the quality of life of our communities in the U.S., but who also shared the same desire to contribute to changing the way of life of our communities back home. So in this respect, NALAC, one may argue, is indeed not only a representative organization of immigrant voices, Latin American immigrant voices, but also perhaps the sole major organization of its nature advocating for what could be described as a transnational or translocal policy vocation, which is fairly unique nowadays.
Yeah, there's two things that, to me, I think stand out about NALAC compared to, there's other, you know, of course, national Latino organizations and so on, but the two things that I think really stand out is one, the base that you have, because it's built up through these federaciones and clubs and so on that have a strong roots within the community. And then, like you said, the transnational perspective that you guys have really brought in issues like trade agreements and the economies back in your home countries and economic policies and so on. All of that has played a role in your work. So it really those two dimensions, I think, are unique for an organization.
Indeed, I think that it is true that there are many other Latino organizations in the U.S. And I would even argue that there are many, you know, immigrant-led organizations of Latinos in the U.S., but not very many of them, I would even argue very few of them, have actually taken that energy and really turned it into a body that can truly say that it represents in a national umbrella, you know, the unified voice of communities of immigrants, whether they be, again, Mexican, Central American, South Americans, or Caribbean. And that's actually something that sometimes we take for granted, you know, but we felt back in 2004 when NALAC was founded that the voice of our communities was actually largely missing from both the debate about immigration policy as well as about the debate of what to do with immigrants, you know, which is a different question than immigration policy. On both counts, you know, we felt very strongly and continue to feel so that we need to do much more work to ensure that the voices of our communities are indeed at the places where these issues are talked about and are decided. I mean, in a way, we are, I guess, picking up, you know, from the old South African saying, nothing about us, you know, without us. And that is something that I think in NALAC we are definitely trying to incorporate. And the other thing is that, you know, if you look at U.S. society as a whole, not even, you know, picking just on Latinos, but society as a whole, there is very little understanding about what goes on in the international arena when it comes to what role do the U.S. government, you know, U.S. corporations play. I think that immigrants, because of the fact that we were born and raised abroad and have experience, you know, what does it mean to really endure the actual consequences of very mistaken policies that have been implemented over the past quarter of a century, and more concretely over the past 15 years in the way of trade agreements such as NAFTA or CAFTA, we do have very much built into our gene, if you want, this concern, you know, with what goes on abroad, both from the point of view of what can we possibly directly contribute to changing abroad, but also we are learning more and more every day how to become organized so that we can have a chance of affecting the way U.S. foreign policy and multilateral policy, where the U.S. plays a very strong role, can become, you know, much more reflective of the concerns of, in this case, you know, immigrant communities coming from all over Latin America.
Yeah, I think something you touch on there, too, is something that I'm really interested in, too, which is changing the perspective of how we talk about immigrants. You know, I think even a lot of Latino organizations or immigrant organizations tend to present victims, immigrants as victims. In other words, you know, they're forced here, obviously, because of economic conditions and so on, but they kind of, it kind of ends with that, right? These are the victims of globalization. These are the victims of economic policy. Whereas I think NAILAC's approach, and I think this is important, is seeing them not just, you know, certainly they're forced to leave their homes, that's understood, but they also in many ways offer a real force for change because of that transnational understanding, because of that realization and the consciousness about, you know, how these economic forces work at a global level, and because that they offer this relationship too between communities both here and abroad that other groups don't.
Yeah, well, I would argue that there is little understanding in the U.S. because in recent history in the U.S., you know, there isn't really anything that we can really point nationally, I mean, as something that could help, I mean, avoid this problem. But there is hardly any understanding about what a survivor really is all about. You know, in many ways, migrants are survivors, you know, of these very ill, very evil sometimes, you know, policies that have been endured, you know, by peoples all over Latin America. And the art of surviving is not just one that comes about as a result of your being helpless, you know, or of your being a so-called victim. But it comes really as a result of being so creative, you know, being extremely ingenious, you know, about the way you will cope, you know, with challenges, you will cope, you know, with hardship. And I think that we bring all that with us, you know, by the time we arrive to the U.S. So I always say, you know, anybody who left their country, left what they knew, left their natural environment and came to a place that in many ways, I mean, is very adverse, you know, very hostile as the U.S., it's got to be a leader. And so we depart from that premise. You know, every single immigrant has already made a statement of leadership by the sole fact, I mean, that they are here. So we don't approach, you know, the question of leadership within our community from a deficit perspective. I mean, we really approach leadership from an asset, you know, perspective, from a capital, you know, perspective. It's the human capital that we bring with us. And I also believe that not only it is true that sometimes, you know, when somebody else speaks about us, we are painted as victims. But I would even go one step farther. I would say that if you look back at how the national political as well as the national policy debate about immigrants has been occurring in the United States of America, there is even a very widely accepted demonization, you know, very widely accepted of the premises that the enemies of immigrants have been really throwing out there very consistently, and that is an image of immigrants as a threat. I find interesting that even people who consider themselves pro-immigrant, you know, pro-fair immigration policies, after so many years of hitting, you know, those rabid anti-immigrant forces, end up buying to some degree, you know, the crap, I mean, that they put out. And I think for us, you know, we definitely depart from an entirely different premise. We are absolutely convinced that immigrants have been, are today, and will continue to be a major asset, not only for the United States of America, but a major asset for our countries of origin. And so, therefore, we don't buy for one second, you know, any notion that pretend to deal with us, whether it be in a small, new areas of destination, so such as Cincinnati, Ohio, or in big cities, you know, like Chicago, Illinois, or New York City, or Los Angeles, in any way that we are a threat, that we are a liability for the country, because we're none of those things.
Now, you've kind of touched on the fact that the previous work of NALOC in the last few years have been on things like the incredible explosion of the immigrants' rights movement that we've seen recently, the big demonstrations that happened. Of course, you've also done a lot of lobbying work and other things. You've also worked on issues of globalization like CAFTA and so on. You were very involved in that struggle. From going out from this convention here in Cincinnati, what is the future goals at this point? What's your the things you hope to accomplish over the next year?
Well, in many ways, I would say that the strategy and the overall, you know, structural analysis that we came up with back in 2004 remains largely in place. And I think that the assembly that we just concluded has affirmed in many ways, you know, that overall analysis, that overall, you know, policy direction. I do believe that there are two things that, in my opinion, really stand out, I mean, coming out of this assembly. One is the importance of really taking a fresh look about how does one go about building political power in the U.S. And that includes, you know, many issues that are in some instances new for many of our communities. And that is, you know, what role do electoral politics, I mean, play in our efforts to build power, but clearly with a very sober understanding that it's not all about elections, that it's not all about, you know, participating electorally, but that clearly that has to become, you know, a factor that we figure out better ways to deal with. The workshop that we had on how to position, you know, the Latino immigrant vote in a more strategic direction, I believe gave us a lot of food for thought and a lot of basis for essentially articulating a new strategy that allow us to basically position ourselves above and beyond the very serious limitations that the U.S. political system imposes on minority communities, minority, you know, voting blocs, such as Latinos or Latino immigrants for that matter. Because while we recognize that, for example, in places like California, Illinois, New York, you know, we have a huge amount of electoral capital, that electoral capital doesn't take us too far, you know, when you put it in the context of what does it mean to live in a country that is bound by an electoral college, you know, and how to really get around, you know, those difficulties. So that's one thing that, in my opinion, stands out. And the second one that really stands out is we have received a very concrete mandate to, you know, really focus energy on building capacity, on really enabling immigrant leaders to be able to really speak with authority, speak solidly, you know, when it comes to why is it that we affirm over and over again that we're not a threat, you know, to our country, enable us to be able to build alliances, particularly with the African American community, but frankly, you know, a multifaceted organizational, institutional relations strategy that allow us to really overcome a lot of the prejudice that exists outside about us, but also in the same process, overcome prejudice that exists within us in relationship to other communities. And so when I put the two together, I mean, I believe are going to be beginning this coming year, entering into a path of essentially building leadership, building, you know, much more seriously our organized power within our own communities, building the alliances that we need, but at the same time with the clear goal of being much more deliberate about the need to exercise power. I loved the conclusion that our president, in a way, ended up with, I mean, saying we are inevitably bound to lead. We are inevitably bound, you know, to exercise power. And I think that that is a very commonly shared, you know, desire. But I add the caveat, you know, it's not just about the fact that we will indeed exercise power. It's about what kind of power and how are we going to exercise this that will really make a difference, not only for our communities and for our countries of origin, but also for our fellow brothers and sisters throughout U.S. society.
You touched on, too, this issue of the relationship to the African-American community, and this, of course, has been a big issue for anybody working on the immigrants' rights problem, which is, you know, in many ways, the African-American community should be a clear ally. There should be a clear linkage of struggles there. But, of course, there has been, unfortunately, a lot of tensions between the two communities. I know that that was something that you worked at this conference. I attended the workshop on racism that you had. There was actually somebody from the NAACP, I know, that showed up to that and so on. Is that coming along? Is that really something that's been able to work on?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we dedicated the evening of Friday night, you know, the opening day of our leadership conference, to a event in which we actually captured very much what NALAC wants to do, which is to really not only come close, share the same roof, you know, with our brothers and sisters in the African American community, but really talk about the challenges and talk about the perceptions, you know, that we each have about each other. And I can tell you that that event on Friday was absolutely powerful in the sense of really bringing to the forefront how much we really share the same pain, we share the same hardship, we share the same structural oppression, and yet we also came, you know, very close in bringing to the forefront about understanding each other, how forces external to our community seek to pit us apart, pit us, you know, one against the other, but at the same time acknowledging that there is a lot of prejudice that we need to overcome, you know, from one another, and that's not going to happen, you know, unless we really sit down, talk, and begin to build trust, you know, among our communities. So I feel that the event Friday night, you know, the workshop that we had yesterday, has really been two events, you know, within this particular conference that will have long impact in terms of helping us really hone in this particular question of how to overcome the divide, you know, between African American communities and Latino, particularly Latino immigrant communities. And I would add one thing. We have been very clear, you know, about the importance of building the alliances that we saw a little bit of in this conference in relationship to African American communities. And what has really prevented us from advancing much more decisively so far is the fact that for reasons that are not necessarily something we can talk about right now because of lack of time, but there are some, you know, very interesting dynamics in U.S. society that have really prevented NAILAC from securing, you know, access to the financial resources that would be necessary to really take what we are trying to do to reality in a much more clever way. All I can tell you is that the way resources flow, particularly in terms of the larger trends within, for example, philanthropy in the U.S., tend still to favor support for those who are willing to defend immigrants, willing to speak for immigrants, but it hasn't really gotten yet to the point of truly empowering organized immigrants as an essential part of that process.
Well, we'll definitely have to talk about that another time. I'd like to go more into that. There's another issue I definitely want to touch on, which is NAILAC has tried to provide a comprehensive view of what immigration reform should look like. And I know this has been, again, something that's been different between you and some of the other organizations out there, because a lot of the groups, I think, have looked primarily how do we deal with the people that are here. And those groups have generally said that they will not accept any guest worker program as any a part of a immigration reform. I know you guys have a little bit of a different position on that. I think it relates to the fact that you're trying to deal with the question of what happens after we, you know, regularize the status of the people that are here. What happens with future flows? Can you talk a little bit about your position on that?
Well, let me begin by saying that we are absolutely clear that for as long as, you know, we continue to live in the process called globalization that is largely led by the United States of America, at least in as far as the Western Hemisphere is concerned, which brings with us, I mean, so many things that we don't even realize, such as, for example, the homogenization of culture, the homogenization of especially consumer culture throughout Latin America, we are going to continue to experience migration, because this reality of globalization is happening at the same time in which the asymmetries, you know, between what life looks like in the U.S. versus what life looks like in Mexico or any other country in Latin America continue to be so ignored, you know, in the debate. And so we are absolutely convinced that for as long as, number one, the asymmetries remain as deep, you know, as they are right now, as, you know, diametrically opposed as they are right now, and second, for as long as we continue to essentially assault local cultures in Latin America, we are going to have a hard time really stemming, you know, the flow that comes, you know, as a result of this globalization process, which is migration. But with that said, where we do, I believe, have been somewhat apart, I mean, from other organizations in the U.S., but and I would even say that the differences have been closing lately, not necessarily because we all agree on the same thing, but because I perceive that some organizations in the U.S. have pretty much come to accept not so much what they proposed about what to do, for example, with the notion of, you know, guest workers or other ways of dealing with what in practice is a regionalized, you know, labor market. But because I feel some groups have actually accepted the terms of those who all along have been in favor of, you know, guest worker programs from a very exploitative point of view. Where we stand, I mean, as NAILAC, like in relationship to what to do with the fact that even if we were to grant legal permanent residency to everyone who is here without authorization, given these asymmetries that I already talked about, given this very profound, you know, codependence in terms of the same sources when it comes to how culture gets to be shaped, you know, in Mexico, for example, is to actually accept the fact that there will be people who will want to come to work to the U.S. even though they don't have, you know, a relative already in the U.S., they don't have any way to really come in as immigrants, legally speaking. And we believe, therefore, that the notion of a temporary worker program is not indeed as evil as it can possibly be made to be sound by others if we set the right, you know, conditions in place. And for us, there are several conditions, you know, that need to be in place in order to avoid a program of that nature to become as, you know, exploitative as they have been in the past. For example, number one, universality of rights. I mean, we completely support the notion that a foreign worker is no worth less or more than a U.S. worker. So every single law that is applicable to a U.S. worker ought to apply to a foreign worker if they are working in U.S. soil. As a matter of fact, we believe we need to begin thinking about labor standards and minimum rights when it comes to working rights throughout the world. But definitely, if they are going to come to the U.S., they cannot come under a different, you know, set of expectations or rules. For example, would you as a U.S. citizen accept to be bound by an employer? You know, that's inhumane. You know, that's inconsistent with the notion of universality of rights. So just to elaborate a little bit on what that means in a practical sense. Second of all, we believe that once a so-called foreign worker has clearly gone beyond any reasonable notion of temporariness, that foreign worker should be entitled to self-initiate a petition to adjust into legal permanent residency status in the U.S. because clearly, you know, that is not something that we should live with, again, for any more years than any reasonable measurement of temporariness goes. And so if those two conditions are in place, we believe we would be very much underway in as far as making of the potential need that we may have to bring foreign workers and the pressures that there will be on people in countries like Mexico, given the asymmetries I already spoke about, to want to come to the U.S. And there may even be, you know, another example of the kind of rule that will be good to have in place. Right now, as it is, you know, there are a lot of people coming into the U.S. as temporary workers, whether they are H-2Bs, you know, or H-2As workers, and they are being actively recruited by people, unscrupulous people in a country like Mexico that are doing a lousy job because they are essentially selling, you know, these visas. That kind of system would need to be profoundly to reform before a temporary worker can really function in a way in which it serves the economic interest of the U.S., but also the humanity of the worker.
We talked about the fact that one of the key features of NAILAC's work is these organizations, some of them are, you know, social service-oriented organizations or community-oriented organizations, but it's bringing in an international perspective there and talking about these international and transnational issues like globalization and like free trade agreements. And, of course, we mentioned earlier that you had done a lot of work on CAFTA. In particular with the issue of trade agreements and globalization, are there specific goals that came out of this conference and that work?
Yes, indeed. I mean, we actually divided our deliberation in three different spaces. You know, we had a third of our attendees focus on, you know, what locally, regionally should be lead priorities for the next year, what should those priorities be in the national arena, and what should those priorities be in the international arena. And it is very obvious that when it comes to the international arena, issues of advocacy in relationship to how U.S. international policy is articulated has really taken, you know, centerpiece in the mandate that we received. And that specifically relates, you know, to issues of trade policy, overall U.S. international economic policy, foreign policy, generally speaking. But also, it was interesting that for the first time, I think, that there was a clear recommendation that we begin to focus on two other things that are very interesting. One is environment. I think that our communities, especially, you know, in the last few weeks, we've seen how Tabasco in Mexico, you know, got so flooded. We've seen also what happened in the Dominican Republic in relationship to the effects of hurricane. So when we look at the actual environmental impact, you know, that by way of natural disasters we are enduring in Latin America, this is making us think, you know, what stand should we take in relationship to these issues. But second of all, questions of food sovereignty, for example, are also beginning to surface as very important issues. And, you know, some people were saying, well, we need to be looking more clearly about what, you know, the entire farm bill is all about in the U.S. and to what extent that is impacting issues of food sovereignty in a country like Mexico. So while, you know, we don't necessarily come out with the exact recipe of public policy areas where we need to be active internationally, clearly when you look at the symptoms of what we are talking about, there is a very rich sense of awareness by our bases, by our communities, in as far as where do we need to go next beyond, you know, issues just of trade policy or overall economic policy.
And that was Oscar Chacon at NALOC's annual leadership conference in Cincinnati, Ohio last weekend. That's all for tonight's program. Before we go, I want to remind you can find out more about the issues, organizations, and people discussed here on Labor Express by going to our website, which is www.laborexpress.org. Again, that's www.laborexpress.org. Labor Express is a nonprofit affiliate with IBEW Local 1220. The views expressed on Labor Express are those of its producers, not necessarily those of IBEW. Labor Express is a production of the Committee for Labor Access in Chicago, the world capital of the labor movement. Tune in again next week at 7 p.m. for another edition of Labor Express.